first things first, before any Oxford comma adherents come at me, my talk today, and like that song, is not really about the Oxford comma. I'm not interested in debating the merits of that particular piece of punctuation, nor will I endorse a position on its use. Rather, this is really all about the debate. So, but of course, for those uninitiated, maybe not aware, not obsessed with grammar, it's probably best to start with a quick explanation of what I'm talking about when I talk about the Oxford comma. Now, the actual name of the punctuation is a serial comma, not the Oxford comma, but it often gets associated with Oxford University, not because it really has anything to do with Oxford University, or Harvard, which it also is sometimes connected to, but more likely because it sounds, you know, quite erudite to associate it with a venerable institution rather than a homonym for breakfast food. But what is it, right? So, the serial comma is that last comma that you will sometimes find before the conjunction that comes before the end of a written list, when the list is written out in prose. So, for instance, I went to the store for milk, comma, eggs, comma, and bread. Instead of, I went to the store for milk, comma, eggs, and bread, right? Now, in most cases, the inclusion or lack of a serial comma is completely innocuous and has absolutely no bearing on the meaning of the sentence. However, there are some cases where one little comma makes a big difference. For instance, and we're going very low tech here because I don't know how to share my screen on Facebook. I was looking, couldn't find a reliable way. So instead, I'm going to go very low tech and hold up an example of a place where an Oxford comma changes the meaning of the sentence. Here we go. So the last to arrive were the dancers, Barack Obama and Justin Trudeau. And now I'm realizing that you might be seeing that backwards because I'm using my front-facing screen. But anyway, here's an example of a sentence that gets thrown up a lot. Different people are thrown in there, but essentially the lack of the comma makes it sound like the first clause of the sentence is describing the second clause of the sentence, right? So the last arrival of the dancers, who were the dancers? Barack Obama and Justin Trudeau, which makes for a sort of a funny image, right? These are the dancers. Now, take out my Sharpie and I do one little mark here, and suddenly the sentence changes and you have the last to arrive are the dancers, Barack Obama, and Justin Trudeau. So now you have a list, right? So we can't confuse the fact that, that Justin Trudeau and Barack Obama were the dancers. No, the dancers came in, then these three. So this is one case where you could say, yeah, the Oxford comma saved that sentence. It alleviated confusion. Now, of course, there are other ways to fix a sentence like this that don't involve an Oxford comma and arguably would actually make the sentence more clear. First of all, just a little tip, you could rearrange the sentence so that you don't have this kind of confusion. And one of the best ways to do that is to never put an abstract noun before two proper nouns or sort of distinct nouns. So what do I mean? An abstract noun is, of course, dancers, right? This is anybody. This is not a specific thing. This is describing a group, right? So instead, you could have written this, the last to arrive were Barack Obama, Justin Trudeau, and the dancers, right? In which case, you don't have to use an Oxford comma because Barack Obama is a proper noun, Justin Trudeau is a proper noun, and then the last one is an abstract noun. So anyway, I'm getting into it a lot, but getting into the weeds here on grammar. But a quick tip, always put your proper nouns before your abstract nouns, and then you won't have to worry about getting called out, you know, for not using an Oxford comma, except by, of course, the most pedantic adherents of the Oxford comma, adherence of the Oxford comma, which is not something you should worry about at all. So now, at the risk of becoming pedantic, the word I just used there, I'm going to also take a moment to explain the word pedantic for anyone who doesn't know what it is, because it is central to what I'm talking about here. So to be pedantic is to act like a pedant, right? So now bear with me as I commit the ultimate crime of public speaking as I quote from the dictionary. But Merriam-Webster defines a pedant as, quote, one who is unimaginative or who unduly emphasizes minutiae in the presentation or use of knowledge. Or one who makes a show of knowledge. Now, interestingly, the original and now obsolete definition of pedant was a male school teacher. So, which kind of links to the current definitions, or it links the current definition to the modern idea of mansplaining, which I think I find very funny. So it's not because, you know, it's almost like this phenomenon of men over-explaining things has been going on for a while. Now, before you get on the comments here, to sort of point out that I am being, how pedantic I am being about both the Oxford comma and about being pedantic, know that I am aware of my pedantic, which is not a word, that I'm doing all this to sort of further explore this phenomenon. So, you know, from that vantage point, you could kind of say that I'm being kind of meta-pedantic, which is not a word, nor should it be. So let me get back to this debate over the Oxford comma, which is not a real debate, but rather sort of this amorphous, mostly internet phenomenon where individuals employ grammar shaming to pretentiously elevate their knowledge of sentence structure via memes that feature images of the sort of like the sentence that I mentioned earlier, right? Images of politicians in dressing and, you know, dancing and whatnot. And occasionally, the debate becomes even more destructive when sort of grammar shaming is used as a means of silencing opposing views by attacking the structure of a sentence rather than the substance. So it's an attempt to make the writer of a sentence feel that if they are too stupid to know how to write a sentence, for instance, leaving out an Oxford comma, that maybe they're too stupid to understand the issue that the sentence, the issue that they're writing that sentence about. Or I guess actually I should say about which they are writing that sentence, because I don't want to be accused of ending a sentence with a preposition. You annoyed yet? You should be. So now let me clarify something. I am not opposed to the serial comma. If you like to use them, use them. I use them all the time, actually. If you look at the title that I put on the blurb, use as an Oxford comma, even though technically doesn't need one. When I grade papers and the students cause confusion in their writing by putting their abstract nouns before their proper nouns and lists, I suggest they add a comma. When they don't, I don't. If you're a lawyer and you're not using a serial comma in your contracts, your clients may be in for a world of pain one day. If you think your religious adherence to the serial comma rule automatically makes you a better writer, you're likely missing a lot of mistakes in your writing. If you find yourself getting angry right now that I am suggesting that there is not one right side or wrong side of this debate, I suggest you look up the word ideologue. Okay, so that's enough both-siding for me. I'm highlighting these little commas because of the surprising amount of controversy that they've generated over the last decade and a half, and the way that works as a pretty perfect metaphor for some of the larger social issues that have been becoming increasingly dominant in our culture and in our world. So, this song that I began with, Vampire Weekend's Oxford comma, you know, gets at some of the heart of this by using the Oxford comma as an entry point for talking about these sort of larger social constructs, which of course include language, grammar, and even that precious little serial comma. They're all constructs, and they tend to act, like many constructs, as agents of division and suppression. Now, the songwriter of this song, Ezra Koenig, said that he wrote this song after he first heard about a Columbia University Facebook group called Students for the Preservation of the Oxford Comma, and started writing a song that he said is not so much really about the Oxford comma as it is about the way humans tend to get hung up on these little things, right? Essentially, the song expands out from a piece of punctuation that some people get very pedantic about to larger ideas that tear people apart. So he asks, who gives an F about an Oxford comma? I've seen those English dramas too. They're cruel. Now, this is from Vampire Weekend's first record, which came out in 2008. And excuse me for a moment while I die a little inside, while I realize that's 14 years ago. But over the subsequent records, Koenig has shown himself to be really a master of lyrical minimalism and a clever deployer of double meanings and puns. This first line is no exception. right? The double meaning of the term English drama points to a sort of genre of theater, film, novels, or whatever that evoke everything from Shakespeare's plays through to Regency era novels from writers like Jane Austen to Victorians like Oscar Wilde to 20th century writers like George Bernard Shaw, all of whom wrote stories predicated on notions of propriety and class values, wherein characters had to navigate social mores and expectations on their way to finding some sort of resolution, whether that was marriage, financial success, or a cold and bitter death, all of which very real possibilities. But the English dramas can also refer to these sort of endless battles happening within the English language, wherein groups like Students for the Preservation of the Oxford Comma attempt to police others' use of English and the illogical way that some people try to preserve something like language, which is inherently malleable. The only constant of language is that it will constantly change. The speaker follows this line up with a declaration about a lack of pedantic by saying that if there is another way to spell a word, it's fine. And so don't be cruel, you know, like these English dramas. The lyrics then shift to this sort of conversational mode, and these as these sort of you and I characters or figures are introduced. And this doesn't, the sort of you here doesn't feel like the kind of indefinite you that often pops up in songs, right? But rather the person, this seems like a person that the I character is arguing with, right? So in the second line, you have this, why would you speak to me that way, especially when I always said that I haven't got the words for you, right? So this is very much back and forth. And we can imagine that this is a response to that first stanza, right? And that the first stanza is a response to the song, by the song's I, to some grammatical correction offered by the song's you, right? Perhaps you told I that they forgot an Oxford comma. And so I responded thus with that first line, right? Who gives an F? Thinking about it this way, it sort of makes us realize that we are entering into the middle of a much larger argument, right? The kind that's built on a much larger framework of grievances that have been brewing for days or weeks, years, maybe decades. You know, those times when you, when your question about how your partner slept is returned with a very angry response about your youngest child's terrible sleeping habits and the imbalance of who gets up in the middle for those middle of the night screams. Yeah, no, me neither. I've never experienced that. The use of the word all is another tip off, right? To the sort of lingering nature of this argument, right? So the speaker says, all your diction dripping with disdain reads a bit like, you always leave the dishes on the counter, or you never remember to close the garage door. All your diction, every word you say, every conversation is dripping with disdain. It's this kind of overstatement that expresses the exasperation of at the heart of the argument. This I, already insecure that they don't have the, quote, words for you, is even further humiliated in this moment to the point of hyperbolic accusation. And then there's this line, through the pain, I always tell the truth, right? Another cryptic line, but one that speaks to the difficulty of expression, especially when that expression comes through language, that the expressor is worried will be misunderstood or mocked if it's not perfect. It is a declaration at the end of the exchange of the syntax. It's a declaration that at the end of this exchange, that even if the syntax I uses is not clear enough to pass use standards, the substance will always be true. And then the next stanza, the song, the argument, I'm not going to go through the whole song, but I just want to get a few little points here. So in the next stanza, the argument expands outward. And I'm not going to try and also decipher any sort of unified narrative to the song or impose one, because I don't think there is one naturally. Instead, Kang seems to be using a number of impressionistic phrases and images to consider larger implications of a pedantic approach to life, wherein we judge others by our standards, and dismiss what others may have to offer based on our own ability to understand them. For instance, the speaker says that he climbed the Dharamsala, which is a sacred site of Tibetan Buddhism. And it's where, of course, the Dalai Lama lives. And the speaker says that he met the highest Lama and that his accent sounded fine. Again, here we can see a speaker attempting to break through barriers of understanding that we are sometimes too lazy or too prejudiced to get through. An accent, like grammar, is something we use to judge the quality of an idea, despite its affect being fully structural rather than substantive. Our judgment of the accent affects our assessment of what is being said. You know, how many times have you seen actors or comedians, friends, maybe you yourself, you know, when you're trying to sound stupid as you say something sarcastic, you know, throw on a southern accent, right? I know I've done it many, many times. Or consider the reverse, right? Putting on a British accent when you want to say something smart or erudite, right? The tones and cadences of our accents have connotations. And we employ those connotations when we want something we're saying to have a greater impact, either good or bad. And so, you know, this is where this idea, right? You can almost hear that line, his accent sounded fine to me, as a response to somebody saying, well, I'm sure he's very wise, but I can't understand a word he's saying, right? You know, it's just like, I'm sure this professor is very smart, but I don't want to do the work to decipher their accent, so I'm just going to drop the class, which is something people do. So, you know, it's something to consider again, right, in this barriers that are set up. Now, the line in the song that I love, and I'm going to kind of end my analysis of the song with here, because, again, I don't want to go through it line by line, but is this line where he says, why would you lie about how much coal you have, right? Why would you lie about something dumb like that? And I love this because on the surface, it is so out of nowhere that it's kind of comical. Right, so far we've been talking about punctuation and accents and the dedication, and accents, and now we're talking about coal. Why are we talking about coal? But it makes sense in terms of these sort of random characters and the dedication they have to the arcane and the obsolete. Coal as an energy source, is arcane and obsolete. It's dirty, it's harmful to the environment. It's absolutely detrimental to the miners that have to get it out of the earth, and it's inefficient, especially compared to newer types of fuel and energy sources. Yet, as recently as the last U.S. presidential election, and probably the next one, it was a major issue because Pennsylvania, a swing state, is a major coal producer. And so you had politicians, and you will continue to have politicians, singing the praises of this obsolete and problematic resource in order to win support, right? They will lie about how much coal they have. Why would you lie about something dumb like that? Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say, just in case any of you are worried this is where I'm heading, to say that the Oxford comma is obsolete, but there is a connection here between the idea of lying about how much coal you have and bragging about one's use of punctuation, either using it or not using it, because both of these phenomena tend to occur when we lose perspective about just how ridiculously out of step we have become with how, at best, challenging and at worst, absolutely brutal it can be to make it through the day. Now, In Leo Tolstoy, his short essay, well, it's short for Tolstoy, it's like 70 pages, at least, called A Confession, he describes a situation that feels familiar to life. And I'm realizing now that I left the book that I was going to read from in the other room, so I'm going to just try and paraphrase the story. So he calls this an old Eastern fable about the nature of life. And so what he describes is a man, he says a man, right, but a person, obviously anybody, out in a field somewhere, is suddenly, confronted by thieves or some sort of adversary and is running from them and discovers a hole in the ground, a pit, or a well is described as, right. And decides that he's going to jump in there and hide in there. gets into the well, looks down, notices that there is a ferocious dragon at the bottom of the well, ready to eat up anything that falls into the well. So on the one hand, he's got these people looking for him on the surface, and at the bottom, he's got this dragon. Meanwhile, the only thing he can hold on to is a small branch that is sticking out from the wall, and so he grabs a hold of that. And as soon as he's grabbed it, he looks and he sees two mice, one black and one white, that are gnawing, they're sort of circling and gnawing away at this branch that he's holding on to, right? And so he's really stuck in this place. He can drop and die, he can go up and get attacked, or he can continue to hang there for as long as these mice, it takes these mice to dig through. As he's doing that, though, every once in a while, some honey drips off the leaves of the branches, and so he's able to eat that, and it's sweet and wonderful and all of that. And this is sort of what preserves him, right? Keeps him from losing his strength. Now, like any fable, obviously, there's sort of, there's a lot of metaphors going on here. Now, Tolstoy uses this and gets very depressing with it. So I won't go down his road, but he's writing about this, he's writing about his life at a time when things were very difficult for him. So we won't get into that. If you're interested in it, you know, go find it. But sort of pessimistic as it is, this image kind of perfectly captures a lot of the realities of life, right? The black and white mice represent day and night in their endless sort of revolutions, gnawing away at this branch that is our connection to life. It was a ferocious wild animal on the surface. There's different versions of this, but in this one he says a wild animal. On the surface represents what Shakespeare might call, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And of course this dragon at the bottom is all of our eventual and unavoidable deaths. So it's bleak. But if you're like me, it feels familiar, right? Especially when we've spent too much time doom scrolling. And for the record, any time spent doom scrolling is too much time spent doom scrolling. But as I said, there's something familiar about this, right? And what's interesting, of course, is that Tolstoy is writing some 150 years ago, and he's describing a fable that he calls old, right? So we're clearly going back pretty far. And yet it resonates because it speaks to the universal absolute that life is hard. And it's hard for everybody. The ways in which it's hard may be different, but our personal judgment of the difficulties of others doesn't make life any less difficult for them or for us. Now, this is not to ignore the honey in the story, of course, because we all have that too, right? And maybe you don't see it right now, but it's in our lives, right? Good food, a great book, when your team wins, when your kids are born, learn to walk, or graduate, you know, a much-needed conversation with a dear friend, finding some extra fries at the bottom of your McDonald's bag, waking up too early and realizing that you have a couple more hours to sleep, a perfect vacation, knowing that you're doing what you're meant to be doing, having time to just listen to records, a cool breeze on a hot summer night. This is the honey of life, right? And sometimes it's all the more sweet because we know we're holding on by a branch, hiding from a wild beast and watching those mice chew and looking down at a dragon. Now the point is that every person is hanging from the branch. The point is that person, right, in Tolstoy's story, hanging from the branch is all of us, right? We have this shared experience. It's something that we tend to forget. I tend to forget. I think I'm the only one struggling, the only one whose life is hard, that everyone else has, as Atticus, my son, likes to say, has their poop in a group. You can shift the words on that, figure it out. And therefore, all of these other people do not require or deserve my graciousness. We get especially vitriolic when somebody perceived to be privileged or at least of a higher status expresses frustration with some aspect of their life, right? We've all seen this. This is where that whole first world problems idea comes from, right? And while I think that it is important, of course, to check your privilege before taking to social media to vent about the price of parking downtown or the lines at the bank or that your local high-end boutique grocery store stopped carrying your favorite brand of caviar, I also think that it is important to check our privilege when we feel entitled to mock, criticize, or otherwise attack someone for doing so. Because let's be honest, we've all at some point in our lives been more angry than we should be at the cost of something, the length of lines, or the lack of something that we want to eat, especially when we really want to eat it. This sort of perspective and distance allows us to avoid being angry about what, you know, famed psychoanalyst, sometimes defamed, some, you know, mostly a historical interest, not current practitioner interest, Sigmund Freud, called the narcissism of small differences. This is when we have so much in common that the smallest variations get blown out of proportion. So, see any dissertation defense, online fan forum, comments section of a controversial news story, political debate, or for an extreme example, the Rwandan genocide. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to go any further down the genocide road. It's too early on a Sunday morning for that. Instead, I'm going to come back to the Oxford comma, the debate around the Oxford comma, which is almost a textbook definition of the narcissism of small differences. Who gives an F about an Oxford comma? That's the question I pose to myself every time I want to get petty and pedantic about what someone else is doing. Should I really get that upset about someone's lack of a small squiggly line, or their run-on sentence, or that they use the wrong form of their? Do I really care that in trying to emphasize the word good in a Facebook post, somebody adds a dozen D's to the end of the word so that it reads, "This cheesecake is so good," rather than expanding the O's in the middle, which is what you should do. Okay, sorry, I'm getting pedantic. Probably not. I probably shouldn't get that upset about it. Are these sloppy mistakes or knowledge, lack of knowledge about proper grammar really a harbinger of the death of the English language, as is so often argued? It's unlikely, especially because the English language has been dying for about 1,000 years now. To expand beyond grammar, does same-sex marriage cheapen my hetero marriage? I don't know. Have all those heteroracial marriages cheapened your homoracial marriage? Does someone else worshiping their idea of God challenge the nature of my faith? It shouldn't, and if it does, how flimsy is my faith? One second. Jesus had an interesting way of describing Freud's idea, an interesting image. It's found in Matthew 7. Jesus asks, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" It's actually pretty hilarious to image to visualize, and that's probably why it drives its point home so well and why it's so well known. I can imagine myself sort of walking around thinking this tiny speck in someone else's eye is a major issue for them, and so I offer my unsolicited help. Meanwhile, I'm causing all sorts of damage to myself and to others because I've got a whole log sticking out of the front of my face that's probably bumping into things, hitting my friend in the face, knocking stuff off shelves, and all the while I am emphatically explaining the importance of good eye health. The reality is that in that moment I am totally useless because I am totally helpless. And I'll stay that way until I can recognize that this massive branch sticking out of my, that I have this massive branch sticking out of my eye. Now, Jesus recommends simply removing the branch, which I think is very good end goal, and in the sort of succinctness of his prescription has a lot to do with how the Bible is written. But I think it's important to remember that removing something as big as a log from our eye is challenging, right? It's difficult, and it probably this thing that has been there for a while, it's not going to be easy to remove. And will probably result, in removing it too quickly, will probably result in a new problem, right? And if we take the metaphor to this idea of hypocrisy, a new version of your old hypocrisies, right? So, ever had a friend find religion and then become as obnoxious about it, about you coming to their church as they used to be about you coming to the bar? Ever seen someone switch political ideologies only to have their meme game become just as annoying on the other side of the issue? Right? These folks haven't lost their planks. They've just moved them to the other eye. Rather, I would suggest that losing your plank is a long process of enlightenment and discovery, with progress and setbacks, kind of like the process of removing a large tree from the ground. Fortunately, I live in an old neighborhood that has a beautiful tree canopy. Unfortunately, Dutch elm disease has been wreaking havoc on some of the trees around my neighborhood, and so I've watched as crews have come and cut down trees. And the one thing you notice is that they don't start at the bottom of the tree, right? They don't just take a chainsaw and cut it down and whatever happens, happens, right? They have ladders and all sorts of things, and they start at the top and they start cutting things away, right? They begin by cutting away large branches and pruning away leaves and all of that sort of stuff, and sort of cutting it down as they go, so that it will lessen the kind of footprint that the tree will take up when the tree actually comes down. And we've got to think about our planks in the same way. Maybe we cut off a bit of the end. We prune some branches that have started to develop. And while we're doing that, we can learn how to better maneuver in our spaces so that we don't hit anyone in the head or knock over a valuable vase. We also learn how to dodge other people's planks, because chances are what we see as a speck in someone else's eye, you know, a minor inconvenience, is more like a plank than we realize. When we recognize that the things that seem small to us are actually quite large, we learn how to give space instead of filling every vacuum with unsolicited advice. And the reality is, we may never lose our planks entirely, but at some point the log will shrink enough for us to notice all of the other planks, and we'll realize that those planks are a lot like Tolstoy's branch, and that they're not great, but sometimes they're all we have to hold on to. They're what is making us human. They're what's keeping us alive. And when we understand this, maybe we can learn to extend the same amount of grace to everyone else that we extend to ourselves, or vice versa. And we can learn to help one another, or at least coexist with something like understanding, patience, and love.